Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3051, United States of America versus Farzad Daru, appellant. Ms. Tung Singh for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
I have requested 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. There was no manifest necessity for the trial court to declare a mistrial. Why? Because throughout critical points in the deliberations, the court refused to provide the appropriate judicial guidance for a jury frustrated asking for how to apply Mr. Darwui's sole defense, consent. Specifically, that no checks were altered because Dr. Kuz signed in each and every one of them as cash.
The judge instructed on consent, didn't he?
I'm sorry.
The judge instructed on consent, did he not?
He did.
He gave the Thomas charge at some point during the deliberations, right?
Very early on, Judge Sentell.
He gave the Thomas charge during the deliberations, right?
Yes, he did.
Okay. I thought so.
Yes, he did.
And you're going to ask us to write an opinion that will be precedent in this circuit, that where the judge is charged on the issues in question, reminds the jury the charges on the issue in question, gives the Thomas charge, and the deliberation over a period of 3 days, that as a matter of law, that's not manifest necessity. In matter of review, that's not a manifest necessity.
Well, let me take you through these critical junctures at the trial, if I may. And let's start with the Thomas charge, which came after about 3.5 hours of jury deliberation, which is a pretty short time, 11 days of trial, 20 witnesses, 240 exhibits, thousands of documents. So it's a pretty short time. And at that point, the defense counsel asked if he could not give the Thomas charge, recognizing this court's attitude that it does not want that charge used twice. And the court at that time expressed a really short shrift attitude about the deliberative process. Let me quote, so that you're basically telling them they have not deliberated very long. Make another effort, then that's it. They come back and say they're hung, then we're at an end. What was the court's hurry? Why, after 3.5 hours, have we used the one tool?
What was he responding at the time he gave the Thomas charge?
A note from the jury that said, we believe we're hung.
Right.
We believe we're hung.
And you really think we're going to write a precedential opinion that says the judge commits error when he gives the Thomas charge, repeatedly approved by this court, to a jury that says he believes it's hung?
Judge Sentell, let me make it very clear. We are not saying in any way whatsoever that giving the Thomas charge at this time is reversible error. What Mr. Darwui is saying is the confluence of factors over the jury deliberations resulted in the trial court not using his sound discretion in declaring a mistrial. And if I
that
could take
that reminds me, what is our standard of review here, counsel?
It's whether the court used sound discretion in declaring the mistrial.
Something like abuse of discretion.
Well, it's the other side of the same coin. If the courts say repeatedly, well, he had his discretion to use and he didn't apply his sound discretion, so he abused his discretion. So it's just different sides of the same
coin. Can I ask about that jury note? It puzzled me a little bit. It says, at this juncture, we believe that we are hung. It is impossible for us to agree on any parts of the counts that we have reviewed thus far.
This is the last note that you're referring to.
I'm referring to the 1105 on May 26th.
The 1105, yes.
That's the first one.
Yes, I'm sorry.
The first hung.
Yes.
Note. It sounds like it doesn't quite sound like they're hung. It sounds like they're saying we haven't gotten all the way through the indictment. It's sort of an odd note, but it sounds like, we've looked at some of the, how many counts were there?
There were 9 counts.
So it sounds like we've gone through some of the counts and we're hung on those, which I'm not sure would justify any feeling at that point that,
well,
that there's a...
Indeed, Judge Garland, the jury came back at the end of that first day because they only had a couple of hours that day, and they had on Thursday, they came back at the end of Thursday and said, please clarify consent to the court. But they didn't give us any questions, so the court said, come back the next morning and give us your specific questions, which is what they did. And on Friday, this is the second critical point in the deliberations.
They asked some questions suggesting that, deciding one charge, does that decide all the others, which sort of supports the idea maybe they weren't really hung on at 11 o'clock on Thursday.
Judge Garland, they were confused about consent. There were five notes on consent. The first one was Thursday afternoon, and now here are three more right out of the get-go.
So this would support your argument that they weren't hung that long, but the first time they clear that they're hung is not till the last hung note, not the first hung note.
And in response, in our point of our argument, back to you, Judge Sentell, is that when in answering these questions, these very specific legal questions, the court did not answer them specifically. The jurors are asking legal questions, not factual questions. And when you ask, if we find consent was given, must we find him not guilty on all the other charges? That's confusion about how to apply consent. So in response to that...
What did the judge do then?
Well, defense asked, well, say yes, because consent is a defense to every one of the charges. So, and all the charges grew out of the same account. I think if I were the court, I would have said that you should decide each count separately, but consent applies to each one of them, and reminded the jury, because these questions, do you know what, you look at these questions, and what the jury is really saying is, they're looking to see whether defendant proved consent. By the tone of these questions, it's not whether the government proved that Dr. Cooge did not consent to the note.
Well, isn't it a reasonable reading that some of the jurors might have thought that, but others didn't? And you used the word confusion, but really there was disagreement about how consent was to be analyzed in this case. And the disagreement was reflected in a series of notes, as you rightly point out, but ultimately in a note that said, we're unanimous that we're hung.
Well, let's go to the fourth note of that day, okay. Then, Judge Kavanaugh, which is, give us defense counsel a little heart attack. If the fourth note said, whether common sense should override a lack of evidence. I mean, we're looking at jury nullification against the defendant here. Right. And so this is the point where we are arguing that real problems arose. We're beginning to see not just confusion on the part of the jury, but we're seeing a problem of refusing to comply with the judge's instructions. And at that point, counsel says, please tell the jury that they must obey your instructions. They cannot refuse to obey your instructions.
How many times did you tell the jury they had to obey his instructions?
None during deliberations. I'm sure it was in the regular.
It's in the regular charge.
It was in the regular charge, but he refused each time.
It's been there more than once, isn't it?
I didn't.
You have to follow the law as given by the court.
It may, but here were jurors who appeared in a general tone, and we already had a note.
Golly, that might be a reason for a mistrial.
No. Let's bear with me, Judge Sentell, because at this point, the court said to us when we were asking that he give a very specific response to these very specific questions, the court said some of them do not want to interpret it, meaning the consent instruction, to say that they should find him not guilty. I don't think the court should give them that answer. It seems to me when the jury asks a legal question that the court should give a legal response, not just say, I don't think I ought to do that because it might lead them to acquittal. And now I want to take us to the critical.
Where is that in the JA?
496.
Okay, thank you.
And then we come to the most critical note, which is the Friday afternoon note. The jury foreman, it was clear the foreman had written it, said whether the court had further instructions. If a portion of the jury believes the defendant to be guilty, regardless of the consent on any and all charges. And here's where we say there is a problem. And defense again asked for please tell the jury they have to follow the law. Some of them might have missed. They might have been sleeping. They aren't reading it. I don't know what happened, Judge Sentell, but at this point, defense vigorously requested a response to the jury to tell them they had to obey the law. And what he gave was a useless response, but one that made it appear that refusing to follow his instructions was not a problem. Quote, all jurors must fairly and impartially consider all of the evidence in light of the court's instructions. Quote.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, that sounds pretty correct, doesn't it?
Well, that's such a general, when the court's being told that jurors are specifically refusing to apply a specific, not the general note that had come the day before that said, I want out of here because nobody's complying with anything, but a very specific note that it's the defendant's key issue. This is it. This is his defense. That the checks were not altered. Dr. Couge had reasons for making them out to him. When told that the jury is refusing to apply that instruction, and also, as I say, the questions make it sound like they're thinking we should prove this rather than the government prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. If you're one of those jurors and you're saying, I'm not going to apply consent, and you get this note back from the court, you know, just consider all the evidence and my instructions, you've been vindicated. Why should you change at that point? No wonder 30 minutes later a hung jury came back. And again, defense requested the court to instruct the jury that they must comply with the instructions. The court yet again refused.
And the court has already told them they have to comply with instructions. And what he said in the passage you just quoted was totally consistent with that. Counsel, there comes a point when you declare a mistrial. And if you instruct them too much after they're out, and they come up with a guilty verdict, then you're going to be up here saying, well, you coerced them.
I understand that, and I appreciate that.
Almost anything beyond the Thomas charge, when a conviction results, and I think you know what I know, that more often than not, if they get a verdict after the first announcement, it's going to be an acquittal. But if they do get a conviction, you're going to be up here saying it's coercive if you said anything more than the Thomas charge.
But I'm really taking a different tact here, Judge.
I know you are, because it hung this time.
No. What I'm saying is that, and I cite the Bolden case in this circuit, which is the law, that when a jury is confused about instructions, the court has a duty to help the jury understand that confusion. And in Bolden, the one juror just asked one question, and the court only reread the statute and the standard instruction. And the Bolden court reversed, saying,
what happened? And what was the result in Bolden?
Reversal.
What was the result in the district court? Did it hang?
No, it was reversal.
Didn't. No, it didn't.
But there was
a conviction in Bolden, right?
Yes, there was. Yeah. But my point.
The conviction was reversed because of what the judge said to the jury, right?
Yes, and you've led me right to my point, Judge Sentell, which is that if the district court commits what this court considers to be reversible error in the process of jury deliberations, not during the trial, but in the process of deliberations, commits what this court considers to be reversible error, how can that be sound discretion?
What's your best case that constitutes grounds for dismissal? Or you're asking us to order dismissal of the case?
No, I'm asking you to find there was no manifest necessity
in
to
the
declare.
Result of which will be that he can't be retried, right?
Yes.
So you're asking us to order dismissal. What's your best case that an error by the judge during deliberation, when a hung jury results, should be grounds for this court holding there's no manifest necessity and therefore causing dismissal?
Well, you know there's no case law for
that.
Yes, I do, counsel. Yeah, I mean, so.
No court has ever bought that.
No, but I'm asking this court to look at the jury deliberative process
okay. And
to see if the jury was adequately informed of what their major problem was how do I apply this consent, and that because of that, with jurors refusing to comply with the law, that a mistrial was called without manifest necessity.
Could I ask you two quick questions about the prosecution's theory and the evidence in the case.
Do I get my time late? Do I still get my 2 minutes?
No, you don't. We'll probably give I'll tell you what, I'll, 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll hold them and ask the prosecution. I'll ask the prosecution.
Before, and it's not the Fourth Circuit. We don't have the time for you.
Sorry, I'll let you go. I'll ask the prosecution.
Okay. We'll round you back up to a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
I like the Fourth Circuit way better, but I was unable to impose that when I got
here.
I like that too, frankly.
May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. There was no abuse of discretion in the declaration of a mistrial in this case. The mistrial declaration was justified by a clear jury deadlock where the jury had returned 11 total notes over the course of its 3-day deliberations. Those notes included 2 separate deadlock notes. The final deadlock note was clear and express that the jury was unanimous that it was hung.
I think the first one was clear and express.
I do, and I understand the court's earlier question about that note. And if you look at that note, that this is the May 22nd, 11:05 a.m.
Right.
note. They say, at this juncture, we believe that we are hung. The second sentence the court earlier identified, they're saying they don't agree on the parts of the counts they've reviewed thus far. But the last sentence is important because it seems to be in tension with that. And I would suggest that the note is simply poorly written.
It could be poorly written in either direction. Right?
I'm sorry?
It could be poorly written in either direction.
It could. Right? It could. It certainly could suggest.
It certainly doesn't sound like they use the word hung. Whether they have any idea what the word hung means, the judge doesn't instruct them on the meaning of the word hung. What really comes down is to the next two. One suggests that they haven't been able to agree on anything, on any parts of the account, of the counts we have reviewed thus far. Certainly sounds like something is still to come. And the second says we have been unable to agree on any one count. That could easily mean of the ones they've done thus far.
It could also mean that they've reviewed all of the other counts and the note is simply... Yeah.
Could be a misplaced modifier that we're unable to agree thus far on any of the counts that we've reviewed.
Or it could be thus far, comma, it is impossible. I mean, put it anywhere you want.
It could. I agree that there's an ambiguity in the note. But I would suggest that that doesn't really matter because the judge responded appropriately, which is he responded to this note with the Thomas
instruction. That's not the question, though. But if the very first time they indicate they're hung, you go immediately to mistrial, you have quite a different case than if basically 2 full days before, or I guess 1 full day before they've indicated they're hung and he doesn't dismiss the jury until a day later, which is what happened, right?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
If the judge immediately dismisses after the first time that they're hung, that is a disputable question about whether that's an abuse of discretion. If you get one instruction saying we're hung, nothing happens other than you immediately dismiss, that's a different case than if 24 hours earlier they say we're hung and then the judge doesn't dismiss until 24 hours later.
That's correct. That would be a harder case than this one because here you have 2 intervening days where you have a series of notes. You have a much more clear ultimate hung jury note that came on the 23rd. In this case, you have intervening notes in between this hung jury note and the ultimate deadlock jury note where the jury indicates that there is a significant conflict. One of the individual jurors requests to be excused, and I would suggest that alone would support the declaration of a mistrial, and the court needs to...
Really? I've never heard of that one. So, I've had trials where jurors say, you know, really, I've got to go home to my kids. Would we declare a mistrial when somebody says that?
Well, we don't, and that was essentially the court's response to this note, but the note didn't say I'm sick. It didn't say I have a doctor's appointment. It said, essentially, the note said the jury is in conflict. I disagree with these other jurors. I want to be excused. That's a different sort of note than saying, you know, I'm sick or my mother's ill or something of that order. And I'm not suggesting that independently would support a mistrial declaration, but that certainly adds to it. You have these intervening notes. And I'd also suggest that the court needs to consider Arizona v. Washington. In that case, the Supreme Court spelled out the very considerable discretion that the district court has in whether to declare a mistrial, and also identified that in cases where there is a finding of abuse of discretion, that those cases involve a district court judge acting, in the Supreme Court's words, irrationally or irresponsibly, that is, impulsively.
You've got a good standard of review. You have a good standard of review.
That was the discussion earlier. And in fact, if I could expand upon that.
You probably don't need to expand upon that. Let me ask some questions about the nature of the case here. I understand your position is that these questions are irrelevant, but the other side did raise them, I'd like to ask you about them. So the principal evidence for the government are these checks that Kuz says were altered. Is that right?
Well, yes. I would agree that's the principal evidence.
And that evidence, when I look at the checks, there's no evidence that they're altered, right? So it relies totally on his testimony, is that right?
Well, and the testimony of the payees, and Kuz, the payees being, we had witnesses from the payees being a variety of different business entities and people. And
saying that they didn't get the money?
Saying that check had been altered from the original.
How did the payees know? What I'm wondering about is the nature of the evidence here. The only copies of the checks are ones produced by the embassy. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think what the parties had at trial were copies and not the originals.
Right. Was there any effort to try to get the originals? I'm not saying you could. I just wondered whether you tried.
I think that they did, and I think that the appellant in this case at one time possessed the originals, and that's why we couldn't obtain them. But I guess I have two responses.
Wait, the appellant? That I don't understand how the appellant.
Well, he would have received, since he was in charge of, my understanding is he would have been in charge of the bookkeeping.
Oh, I see, at the embassy?
And he received, no, not at the embassy, at the center.
I mean at the center, I'm sorry.
Right, and he would have received the canceled checks in return to the extent they did receive those. But he possessed them, but we, the government.
Some of these look like, the originals were not actually ever returned, that these are sort of check copies, and so that the originals or a microfilm of the originals would have been kept by the bank. You know what I mean? The checks, for example, the check on 516 has at the top amount, account, bank number, sequence number, capture date, check number, which is the kind of thing you get from a bank when the bank isn't giving you back the original, but is giving you back, a copy of the original.
I understand the court's question. As to the nuts and bolts of the scheme,
right,
other than pointing the court to the...
I just wonder, with respect to at least, say, the best evidence rule, if the issue is about the copying of a check, best evidence in this case would be the bank's copy of this check rather than a copy produced by the complainant, which is, I take it, what's happening here.
It would, and I don't know the answer to the court's question. I'm happy to submit a letter with these factual questions, but I do have a partial response. It doesn't directly respond. Obviously, the underlying facts are in the indictment, which is in the record. And the other thing I would point the court to, and it's not directly answering the court's question about the alteration of the checks, but in the defendant's testimony at trial, he conceded many of the things that are part of the government's case, and that's why we argued in closing, and we maintain on appeal that these issues aren't relevant.
I understand the point about the appeal, but he didn't concede that he altered the checks, did he?
He didn't. He had a different explanation for that. His explanation was essentially that he and Kuz worked together, Kuz
right,
being the director.
In some parts, in order to give money to Estrada, correct?
Yes, but what I wanted to point out is that he did concede during cross-examination, the appellant, that he altered the invoices that went to the Saudi embassy. So in some sense...
But that's a different issue. That is an issue about whether he did that so that Kuz could provide money to Estrada. Is that right?
That's correct, right. But we argued that still supported the fraud.
I understand that. But if Kuz, who was in charge, he was the signatory, he was the person able to sign off on these things... You didn't concede that There was no instruction that even if Cooge had agreed that the money could be given to be and therefore transferred to Estrada, that there would be a crime. You didn't get an instruction like that, did you?
That there would be a crime.
Right. Their defense was it wasn't a crime. There was consent, right?
That's correct.
So now here's the part that puzzles me. So I don't understand the government's theory about why evidence that Cooge and Estrada were married wouldn't come in. I mean, it's a complete motive for bias in the testimony and for the scheme that it's the defendant's theory of the case. I don't understand the argument why the defendants couldn't put on evidence that Estrada and Cooge had been married.
Well, the district court found that that was prejudicial. The fact
of course it's prejudicial. It's the end of your case. But that's
you would not,
not
concede that that has anything to do with the single issue before us on this interlocutory appeal.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And our Abney arguments are spelled out in detail in our
I got that part, but your light's still green. We have a little time.
I'm here to answer your questions.
Old trial lawyer wants to figure out what's going on here. I don't understand why, when their whole defense is that Cooge and Estrada have, Cooge is giving the money to Estrada, big reason for it is that they were married, and that they're not allowed to tell. I don't understand why that's more prejudicial than probative.
Well, it's more prejudicial because the allegation is that Dr. Cooge, who's the director of the Islamic Center, has multiple wives.
Yes.
That's prejudicial. But what the court did was balance and
what if imagine it's true, okay? I know this is going to be hard for you to believe. Imagine the defense theory is completely true. Cooge wants to give money to Estrada because they're married, even if it's one of his multiple wives. That's the explanation for why he's giving the money to DeRui. And that's the reason that they're doing it secretly. They can't prove it because that would be prejudicial to the government?
Well, they were allowed to prove it in a sense because what came in was that Cooge, that the director and Estrada had a significant relationship or a serious relationship. It simply wasn't described as being a marriage.
Well, marriage seems like a pretty strong reason why you might give money, maybe stronger than a, quote, relationship. Right. In fact, a relationship sounds like it would be more prejudicial if you just say a relationship than if it's a legal marriage.
Well, it's not more prejudicial because it doesn't necessarily mean a romantic relationship. It could mean some other sort of relationship. But the jury was informed there was this significant or serious relationship, and which would have provided the motive, which was, the court is suggesting, appellant's defense. And so that was an appropriate balancing of the prejudice of saying that the director, the complainant, had multiple wives, as opposed to simply providing the motive that there was a relationship or that Estrada and Cooge knew each other.
If it was true, I don't understand what the prejudice is. If it's true, I mean, imagine instead of a wife, it was a completely unlawful, extramarital relationship. You think that the defendant couldn't put on evidence that the reason the guy is providing money is he's providing money to the person he's having an extramarital relationship with? It seems like that's typical. Imagine you had a bribery case. Imagine it was the government's case, and you were trying to explain why a government official was making payments to somebody not his wife. You would put in that the reason was that they were cohabiting. And you would be outraged that if the court left that out, because that would eliminate your chance for motive.
It's certainly possible to conduct the trial that way. I'm suggesting it's not an abuse of discretion to do what the judge did in this case. Ultimately,
can't you concede that he committed error on every point you've just been questioned about?
Right, and under Abney, it's not.
You don't want to do that because you want to try the case again.
So. Well, we do, and under Abney, it's clear that the court can't look at these isolated errors. Appellant's counsel has admitted that there is no case that supports the theory that the court can. And I would suggest, even in terms of the trial evidence, that was water under the bridge, for the reason I suggested earlier, that the defendant's own testimony, he indicated that, among other things, he submitted fraudulent invoices to the Saudi embassy. So it would, even if that were a trial error, it would have been harmless, even though we're not directly reviewing that trial. If the court has no further questions, I think the court understands the Abney argument, understands our point about the significant amount of time the trial court spent.
Court has no further questions. You'd like to sit down.
That's fine. we urge the court to affirm, having said that.
Okay, what counsel have left? We'll give you up to two for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to contradict the counsel here. I have not conceded that this court cannot take into consideration the other factors in the trial. My argument.
Do you have any case anywhere where a court held that a judge erred in granting a mistrial on a hung jury based upon errors committed earlier in the trial?
No, that's not my point, Judge Sedentel. If you'll just bear with me for a minute.
I bore with you through a long, long brief, little of which had anything to do with
no,
the issue.
But I want to say that every court that is considered manifest necessity and double jeopardy has looked at factors other than the pure deliberative
process. None of them ever reversed any trial judge because of trial error in a case considering manifest necessity.
Well, when they consider that there's no manifest necessity, like the Carsey case here in the district of for this circuit, they looked at the improving the witness's testimony in each trial, which you don't need to improve the testimony here, the defendant's financial burden.
Did any of those cases
manifest necessity
on trial error?
They look
is the answer, right?
Well, Judge Sentell, please bear with me. They looked at the Lansdowne case, looked at the defendant's credibility. His mother testified, his prior record. The Richardson case, which is cited by the government, states that while it cannot consider insufficiency of the evidence as a direct appeal, that it is a component in the appeal.
If we accept your position in this case, district courts are going to be much more reluctant to grant mistrials. I think that's evident. Is that really going to be better or fairer for the criminal justice system to have district courts? They're going to wait longer. There's just no doubt if we write an opinion taking your position here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Bolden court didn't have any problem reversing when the court didn't
revise. No, it reversed decision based on trial error.
And go back. But
that has nothing to do with the question you were just asking.
District courts are going to pause. This would be the first time any court has done this. Be a significant opinion. And district courts will be much more reluctant in this circuit to grant mistrials. I don't see how that's going to be, on the long run, fairer or better for the criminal
Judge
justice.
Judge Kavanaugh, but the ruling would be not that the Thomas charge or any of that was a per se problem, but that the combination, the culmination of one note after another regarding consent where the court
did
not. You
say it's sufficiently fact-specific here that it wouldn't cause.
Absolutely. I'm not asking for any new case law here. I know this court has not done so. I would like to just say one thing, that I understand the give and take of double jeopardy with the government is entitled to one full and fair trial. But here, Mr. Dardui also has constitutional rights to have his case decided by a specific tribunal. And here, the government has had a full trial. It was not a fair trial for Mr. Dardui. And so the question is, does he have to withstand a second unfair trial? Because that is the essence of manifest necessity.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time actually is not only up but over. So, case is submitted. I call the next case.